To the John Jay Memorial Lecture Series in the Cooper Union's Great Hall. This is the seventh in our series, and tonight Professor Newborn is going to be talking about due process. Next week it will be criminal matters, and the final lecture 2 weeks from tonight will be on the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. So we're very pleased to have once again with us Professor Bert Newborn.
Thank you and good evening. It's a pleasure to welcome you back for the seventh Jay Islin Memorial Lecture on the Constitution. I want to note that I've seen a couple of you, and I've come up and told you there are several of you that are in the running for a gold star attendance thing. So I want to tell you how much I appreciate that. That's an extraordinary commitment of your time, and I deeply appreciate it. And my thanks again to Lee Islin and to Cooper Union for inviting me to talk about the Constitution in this storied space, where so much of the Constitution began. This week, I'm going to try to talk about the three meanings of the Due Process Clause. Federalism due process, which is the Due Process Clause acting as a traffic cop, moving power back and forth between the national government and the states. Procedural due process, which is the Due Process Clause operating as a way to control the behavior of government officials when they come into contact with individuals. And substantive due process, which is the Due Process Clause purporting to create rights that are not in the text of the Constitution, but are nevertheless thought to be very important. As you've heard, next week we'll do the constitutional criminal procedure rules, and as we've done a number of times, I have a sense that they fit together in such an extraordinarily careful way, the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments, essentially establishing a perfect chronological picture of the operation of the criminal justice system with special protections at each step in the chronology, that I'm going to go so far as to say that next week's lecture is the poetics of criminal procedure. And the final lecture on Ninth and Tenth Amendments, which is really federalism and separation of powers, is really subtitled In Praise of Seventh Grade Civics. It never got better than the seventh grade for me. So let me start by reading, as you know, I often start a lecture like this with a quote. So let me read you two quotes today. This is a quote from Senator Charles Sumner, who was a senator from Massachusetts and one of the radical Reconstruction Republicans after the Civil War, who fought so hard for the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And this is Senator Sumner in 1864. As you know, the 13th Amendment is 1865, the 14th Amendment is 1868, and the 15th Amendment is 1870. This is Sumner talking before it all happened, during the debate on the floor of Congress about what to do as the Civil War wound down and the Union hoped it was winning. He says this, "Brief as it is, the Due Process Clause is in itself alone a whole Bill of Rights." Then, I want to read a quote from George Orwell from 1984 because it really summarizes how Sumner's vision actually became the truth in the United States. "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." So that if you can control the present and write the history that you want, you can control the future out of it. And that's the story of the Due Process Clause. So it turns out that Sumner was prescient in 1864 when he said that you could shrink the entire Bill of Rights down to four words, due process of law, and not lose much. And given our penchant for judicial activism, the truth is that if you kept the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and got rid of everything else in both Madison's first 10 amendments and Lincoln's 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments, got rid of the first and second Bill of Rights, and just kept the Due Process Clause, nothing much would change. That the helped along by judicial imagination, highly, I think, controversial judicial imagination, but helped along by judicial imagination, the four words due process of law would carry almost the entire weight of the first and second bills of rights all by themselves. But it took 100 years and a remarkable and controversial series of judicial exercises in creativity to achieve Sumner's vision. A look back for a sec. The concept of due process enters our legal heritage, albeit in slightly different verbal form, in 1215. In chapter 39 of the Magna Carta, when British nobility forced the king to promise to refrain from governing them except, quote, by the law of the land. The actual words due process of law make their debut in our legal history in 1354. In a statute of the British Parliament, reformulating, shortening, and codifying the Magna Carta, and making its provisions applicable to all freemen, not just the nobility. Then in 1608, Edward Coke, who was probably England's greatest legal mind, celebrated the role of due process in his institutes. By the way, institutes that were carefully read by Madison, Hamilton, and Jay, who many of you know by now is Jay Islin's great, 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 great grandfather, John Jay. The phrase found its way into colonial charters and early state constitutions, and from there into the text of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. Now, as used in the earliest English manifestations, including Cook, the phrase appears to be intended to prevent the kind of arbitrary government action where the king or one of his henchmen makes up the rules as they go along. Due process of law was aimed at requiring the king to act pursuant to existing law and not above it. And today, I think we would describe the original concept of due process, as it existed in the Magna Carta and the early British experience, as a commitment to the rule of law, as opposed to living under the arbitrary rule of a tyrant whose fiat is law. The sad truth is that today more than half the world would gladly settle for nothing more than that. Much of the effort to foster a transition to democracy from the forms of authoritarian rule in Eastern Europe, Asia, Africa, South America, and the Middle East revolve around the effort to instill a commitment to the rule of law in a legal and political and social world that had known only rule by arbitrary fiat. And a moment's reflection should reveal that a commitment to governing pursuant to law rather than raw power is a precondition to any form of ordered liberty, any effort to use democratic rule, or any effort to have a functioning free market economy. But an abstract commitment to the rule of law, however important that may be, says little or nothing about what the contents of that law is, should be, or will become. The Nazis had a rule of law, appalling as it was. So did apartheid South Africa. Even Stalin and Mao claimed to operate pursuant to pre-existing legal rules. Now, of course, the content of Nazi law was absolutely appalling, as was the law applied in South Africa, Stalinist Russia, and Mao Zedong's China. So if all due process of law means is that a tyrannical sovereign promises to have appallingly unjust laws in place before enforcing them, due process would be thin gruel. In the United States, the four words due process of law have exploded out of that very narrow rule of law meaning and have exploded outward from the Magna Carta in three trajectories. Federalism due process, where the words due process of law in the 14th Amendment are construed as regulating crucial aspects of the relationship between state and federal governments, and an important aspect of the relationship between and among the 50 sister states. Procedural due process, where due process of law in the 5th and 14th Amendments regulate the behavior of the sovereign's agents when they interact with ordinary people as ordinary people go through their days. And substantive due process, where the words due process of law purport to place outer limits on what the sovereign can either prohibit or require, regardless of any other textual provisions. Now, if you think for a moment of those three extraordinarily important roles that the Due Process Clause plays, there's nothing in the text of the Due Process Clause that helps you decide anything about those three things. Due process of law is an open concept into which we pour meaning. It is impossible to read it literally because it doesn't mean anything. It is impossible to read it as original intent because we've changed the original intent from the Magna Carta dramatically. So it's impossible to use any of the forms of constitutional interpretation that we discussed in the first lecture to be able to make sense out of due process of law. And as the lecture goes forward tonight, think what judges are doing when they give meaning to the Due Process Clause and whether it's a legitimate exercise. So let's start with federalism and due process of law. American law is deeply complicated because we are a federal union. While most nations divide their countries into decentralized administrative units, the decentralized units are usually just convenient ways of parceling out a unitary national power to smaller localized units of government that are capable of administering the national law more efficiently than the central government. In most places, the local units draw their power exclusively from the center and, with a very, very few set of exceptions, apply uniform national law. Our political system, which seeks to govern a vast territory with a remarkably diverse population, is much more complex. Our decentralized units, the 50 states, are conceived of as freestanding sovereign nations that ceded a piece of their sovereignty to the national government when they agreed to join the Union and accept the Constitution, but that also retained very important aspects of their sovereignty, authorizing them to make their own laws about many important areas like property, contracts, torts, criminal law. And much of the complexity of our legal system turns on figuring out how much power the states have retained and how much they've ceded to the federal government. The Obama health care decision, which I'll talk about in the final lecture on December 13th, is a classic example of how hard it is to answer that question in many different contexts. Now, you wouldn't think it if you looked at the text, but due process of law, as that phrase is used in the post-Civil War 14th Amendment, which also brought us equal protection of the laws, is one of the most important federalism policemen in the Constitution, both vertically between the states and the federal government and horizontally among the states themselves. The idea of vertical federalism, dividing sovereign power between a center and a periphery, does more than provide for smaller, arguably more efficient governing units. It often enables a weak political minority residing in the local unit that would always be outvoted and often be discriminated against. It allows that small, beleaguered political minority in the local unit to appeal over the heads of the local majority to a larger national majority, to ask the national majority to help protect it against the local majority. So one very important purpose of vertical federalism is to protect the weak people who live in the periphery, who live in the local units. The second purpose is to protect the local units against the national majority. By saying, look, there are some things that the national majority can't regulate, you get to regulate them themselves. Now, if you think again for a moment, since the two purposes of vertical federalism, avoiding local control and empowering local control, are in such direct conflict, one of the crucial judicial tasks in our federal union is to act as a traffic cop, deciding when the political majority in the center trumps the political majority in the periphery and vice versa. There's also, of course, a story to be told about the horizontal role of the Due Process Clause in harmonizing the states and the way they live together. And those of you who raise your hand, I'll come see you tonight around midnight, and I'll be able to tell you about the horizontal stuff, but there isn't time to do it today. Okay. Ellen Roth raised her hand. So what I would like to do is to talk about one aspect of vertical federalism, and that's the decision about what fundamental human rights should look like. Should fundamental human rights be defined differently, state by state by state, in the state bills of rights, or should we have a single national uniform law of fundamental human rights? Now, living as we do in an era in which the national human rights argument has won, it's hard for us to get our minds psychologically around the fact that this was once, and still is for many people, an intensely controversial idea. Because the single most important imposition that the federal government makes on these states that were once sovereign entities and have now entered the union is that it essentially says to those state sovereign entities, you can't define your human rights laws anymore. We define them for you. That's a huge loss of sovereign power by the state and a huge gain of sovereign power at the center. And the story of how that happened is a fascinating story, and it is the Due Process Clause that does it. So let me try to tell you the story. As originally enacted in 1791, Madison's Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, was designed to limit the activities only of the federal government. Had nothing to do with the states. State governments were expected to regulate themselves in accordance with their own conception of human rights, using the bills of rights in their own constitutions. And Madison was really nervous about this. So he put into the original Bill of Rights a provision saying that no state can interfere with freedom of conscience, freedom of the press, or establishment of religion. And he got it through the House, but he couldn't get it through the Senate. So it was taken out of the Bill of Rights and never saw the light of day. And so not surprisingly, in 1833, when the Supreme Court was first asked to decide the question, they decided that the Bill of Rights applies only to the federal government and not to the states. And that remained the law as a matter of theory until the Civil War, and as a matter of doctrine until 1930. When the doctrine began to change, 1931. So the court's pre-Civil War failure to apply the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment freedom of speech to the states, understandable as it is, as a matter of history and a matter of text, was a national catastrophe. It prevented homegrown opposition to slavery from emerging in the southern states, and it paved the way for the Civil War. Because while support for slavery was substantial in every slave state, it was far from monolithic. Many southern revolutionary leaders, like Washington and Jefferson, had urged the gradual abolition of slavery. Patrick Henry refused to become a delegate to the Constitutional Convention because he sensed that the convention was going to protect slavery. Numerous southern senators supported the Northwest Ordinance in 1787, which banned slavery from the Northwest Territories. And throughout his life, Jefferson, in his maddeningly hypocritical way, brilliantly inveighed against the moral evils of slavery. And no man has ever written more eloquent words in the denunciation of slavery while continuing to own and exploit 223 slaves who were sold off to pay his debts when he died. Now, led by Quakers and by Wesleyan Methodists, many southern churches initially opposed slavery. Small planters had no economic stake in the institution. The southern anti-slavery movement peaked in 1832, just after a slave insurrection in Virginia, when the Virginia House of Burgesses, House of Delegates, held a serious debate on whether to abolish the practice. Now, the anti-slavery forces lost, but they constituted a significant political movement with hope for the future. Beginning in 1830, though, southern states enacted laws banning abolitionist rhetoric. First, they concentrated on barring abolitionist literature from the mails, succeeding in obtaining a federal ban on sending anti-slavery literature into a slave state. Then they turned to domestic southern anti-slavery speech. Speech critical of slavery was barred throughout the South in every state, usually on a theory that it might incite violent insurrection. By 1859, it was against the law to circulate Horace Greeley's New York Tribune in most southern states. And in several states, it was a felony to teach a slave to read. Thus, when John Calhoun launched his defense of slavery in 1837, a web of Southern censorship laws, reinforced by vigilantes who used violence to censor speakers and destroy abolitionist presses, made it impossible to mount an organized response. I mean, consider just one person, the fate of Elijah Lovejoy, the publisher of a small anti-slavery newspaper in Southern Illinois. Lovejoy saw his presses destroyed by pro-slavery mobs on three different occasions. On the fourth occasion, when he tried to defend against a fourth attack, the mob killed him. The combined force of a web of repressive censorship laws and the threat of mob violence prevented the emergence of an organized political opposition to slavery in the southern states. By 1860, effective public criticism of slavery in the South had been silenced, leaving no organized political opposition to secession and the Civil War. So Americans don't have to look abroad for lessons on the consequences of government censorship. One wonders what the political world would have looked like in 1860 if the Virginia anti-slavery movement that had existed in 1832 had enjoyed First Amendment protection against state censorship and police protection against mobs as it sought to build a powerful Southern political movement that might have headed off the Civil War. And we'll never know. The post-Civil War enactment of the 14th Amendment in 1868 begins the long march of the Bill of Rights from Washington, D.C., where it only applied against the federal government, to all 50 state capitals, where it governs the every single state. And the march took 100 years. The 14th Amendment, adopted in 1868, is 427 words long. Most of it has nothing to do with rights. Most of it has to do with reversing Dred Scott, talking about who's a citizen, trying to figure out ways to make sure that the Civil War debt gets paid, trying to figure out ways to make sure that Robert E. Lee was never elected to the Senate by barring people who had taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution from ever serving as an officer in the Constitution. All that is in the 14th Amendment. The rights-bearing aspects of the 14th Amendment are only 52 words long, 67 if you count the routine clause at the end saying Congress can enforce it. 21 words are used up by the clause that should have been the bridge by which the Bill of Rights reached the states. The clause that should have been the bridge is the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, which says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. That sounds to me like it's a clause that was intended to bring privileges and immunities, which would be the Bill of Rights, to everybody. And there's in two closely divided Civil War cases, post-Civil War cases, in 1869 and 1873, the court gutted the Privileges and Immunities Clause by reading it narrowly to apply to only a very small category of rights dealing with the inherent relationship of the individual to the federal government, like traveling on the high seas or getting a passport, but having really nothing to do with most of the ordinary aspects of life. And while the idea of national privileges and immunities in my era has made a modest comeback, the truth is it never recovered from the 1-2 punch that it took in 1869 and 1873 and has never played a significant federalism role. And that leaves all of 31 operative rights-bearing words in the 14th Amendment. 2 weeks ago in Lecture 7, we dealt with the 14 words in the Equal Protection Clause. Important as equality is, though, that's not going to be your federalism bridge. So that the Equality Clause, terribly important, leaves only one, and indeed the Equality Clause never was used as a way to make stuff go from the federal government to the states. It went backwards. It's the equality language in the 14th Amendment that has been read back into the Due Process Clause of the 5th Amendment that, as we mentioned a couple of lectures ago, is afraid to say the word equality. How can you say the word equality in a Bill of Rights that is essentially protecting slavery? So they had to, in 1954, they had to take the equality language of the 14th Amendment and read it backwards into the 5th Amendment so that the 5th Amendment Due Process Clause has the same equality protection as the 14th Amendment does. It's a reverse federalism that went from the 14th Amendment back to the 5th. There never was a flow from the Bill of Rights to the states. That leaves just 17 words. It leaves, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's the linguistic hook that's left to try to take the Bill of Rights and move it across to apply not just to the federal government, to the states. And building that bridge took more than a century. Throughout the last half of the 19th century, the Supreme Court consistently repudiated efforts to do that. And in something that ought to tell you a lot about the politics of the Supreme Court and the politics of this nation in the last half of the 19th century, the only provision of the Bill of Rights that crossed that bridge during the second half of the 19th century was the provision in the Fifth Amendment saying you can't take private property for public use without just compensation. So the Takings Clause, which is a protection of property, was transferred and was applicable against the states, nothing else. And the first Justice Harlan said that it's clear that we think that property is much more important than we think than life or liberty. So that property gets protected, but nothing else does. Now, it wasn't until 1925 that the court began its steps toward reading the Due Process Clause as incorporating other provisions of the Bill of Rights. That's the way they talked about it. First, they incorporated the First Amendment. And the first case to do that was in 1931. And then over the next half century, from 1931 until now, over the next half century, the court painfully trundled right after right in the Bill of Rights and trundled it across the bridge built by the Due Process Clause so that it was applicable against the states. And most recently, in a case called McDonald versus Chicago, just a year or two ago, the five justice Republican majority on the court reaffirmed that process and held that the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms that they discovered in District of Columbia versus Heller, was incorporated against the states by the Due Process Clause. And that was a 5-4 decision with the four Democratic justices saying, we believe in incorporation, but we believe that it's selective incorporation, not of everything in the Bill of Rights, but only that aspects of the Bill of Rights that are truly fundamental, and owning a gun is not truly fundamental. But they lost. The Republican majority applied the incorporation test and moved it across against the states. We now live in a world where only two provisions of the Bill of Rights remain to be incorporated against the states: the Fifth Amendment grand jury right and the Seventh Amendment petty jury right. And although it took more than a century and involved judicial acrobatics using that language that are hard to square with textualist orthodoxy and probably uses the wrong clause. They should have been using the Privileges and Immunities Clause. The modern Due Process Clause finally does impose a single vision of human rights on the states, enabling minorities trapped in a hostile political or racial environment to appeal to a national definition of individual rights. And it turned out that both Senator Sumner and George Orwell were both right. The Due Process Clause is, in itself, a whole Bill of Rights. Its Delphic text protects virtually every right contained in Madison's first Bill of Rights, plus the equality provisions in Lincoln's second Bill of Rights. But only because he who controls the present Supreme Court controls the past in order to control the future. So that takes us to the second meaning of due process. The first is the story of how the Due Process Clause was used as a way to nationalize our human rights law and have a single human rights law without any formal constitutional amendment, without any formal text that really did it. We did it over a 100-year painful process. Now, while it's hard to find a textual or a historical link between the Due Process and federalism, a clear textual and organic link exists between the idea of due process of law and fair procedures. If we return for a moment, you know, to the effort to read the Bill of Rights as a poem that I've been trying to stress to you over the weeks, every word is in its particular place in the Bill of Rights for a particular reason. And there's an organic relationship between due process and fair procedure, and you see it in its placement in the text of the Bill of Rights. As we saw in Lecture 3, Madison's Bill of Rights begins with a First Amendment horizontally structured to replicate the half-life of a democratic idea. It begins with protection of the interior conscience in the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses. It moves through speech, which is the articulation of the idea, press, which is the mass dissemination of the idea, assembly, which is the political organization in aid of the idea, and petition, which is the actual interaction with government in trying to get the law adopted. In read with respect for the order of those six ideas, the First Amendment is a living tableau of a tolerant, vibrant democratic process. And Madison then deploys the Second through the Eighth Amendments as a catalog of the physical dangers to the First Amendment's ideal democratic commonwealth posed by organized bodies of armed men, listing the dangers by order of magnitude and chronology. He perceived military overthrow as the most feared threat to the system of government. That's why it's dealt with by the Second Amendment, right after the First. As we saw in Lecture 5, Madison's Second Amendment is designed to neutralize the risk of armed overthrow by a standing army by assuring that the organs of armed coercion, the army and the police force that have the guns and the capability of overthrowing democracy, by assuring that those organs are themselves representative institutions looking just like the people they serve. And as you recall, I argued that the true meaning of the Second Amendment was a right to serve in the army and a right to serve in the police without regard to gender, to race, to sexual orientation, or to religion. And that would guarantee that the army and the police would look like the people they were policing, and it would dramatically minimize the chance of a military overthrow, which usually takes place when the military feels no connection to the people that they are supposedly serving. And so Madison then turned to the next most dangerous threat posed by armed individuals, this time police, the armed law enforcement apparatus. The structure of the Fourth through the Eighth Amendment is a perfect chronological description of a law enforcement process with built-in steps, with built-in protections at each step. The Fourth Amendment deals with investigation and arrest. The Fifth Amendment governs interrogation and charging. The Sixth and Seventh Amendments govern adjudication. The Eighth Amendment regulates sentencing. It's impossible to imagine that such a careful organization emerged randomly. It exists in no other document, in our rights-bearing heritage, or in anywhere else. The careful organization of the Bill of Rights, both vertically and horizontally, is pure Madisonian poetry. Tonight, next week, we'll look at the way that poetry plays out in our law of criminal procedure. Tonight, I want to look at how the poetry plays out in the placement of the Due Process Clause and its companion, the Takings Clause, which prohibits the taking of private property for public use without just compensation. They're both put at the very end of the Fifth Amendment. And what on earth are the Due Process and Taking Clauses doing in a Fifth Amendment devoted to interrogating and charging criminal defendants? And some say nothing. Some argue that the Due Process and the Takings Clauses were just randomly inserted into the Fifth Amendment with no structural reason for being there. But that simply overlooks Madison's poetry. It turns out that nothing in the meticulous organization of the Bill of Rights is random. In fact, due process and takings end the Fifth Amendment for a very good structural reason. Once an armed law enforcement official has conducted an investigation in accordance with the Fourth Amendment, made an arrest in accordance with the Fourth Amendment, conducted an interrogation in accordance with the Fifth Amendment, and decided to prefer formal charges in accordance with the Fifth Amendment, the temptation will become enormous to skip the cumbersome and unpredictable adjudication and sentencing phases in the Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments. The temptation is to go directly to summary punishment. After all, the cop knows the guy's guilty. He arrested him, he investigated him, he interrogated him, and he charged him. And at that point, the cop is ready to use the club. Why go through the other stuff? I know who the guilty person is. Read structurally, the due process and takings clauses are in exactly the right chronological place in the Bill of Rights to nip any temptation in the bud to take shortcuts with suspects whom the cop has already arrested, interrogated, charged, and convicted in his heart. The procedural due process clause assures that suspects formally charged with a crime or simply suspected of criminal behavior may not be deprived of life, liberty, or property without compliance with the elaborate due process procedural safeguards set forth in the immediately following Sixth Amendment, including the right to notice, the right to cross-examine adverse witnesses, compulsory process to summon friendly witnesses, protection against being tried more than once for the same offense, speedy and public trial by a jury, and most importantly, right to counsel. The due process clause is exactly where it has to be to make sure that a suspect enjoys all of those things without having been subjected to a deprivation without due process of law. In short, I'm suggesting to you that due process of law is really designed to summarize the rights that are in the Sixth and Seventh and Eighth Amendments. Similarly, under the Takings Clause, the procedural protections of the Sixth and Seventh Amendments may not be evaded by pretending to seize a target's property for public use, and without demonstrating a genuine need for public use and a payment of just compensation. Ironically, though, the two most important procedural guarantees established by the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments procedural due process clause are not found explicitly in the Sixth Amendment or anywhere else in the constitutional text. They are the requirement of a truly neutral arbiter and the obligation of government, state or federal, to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt before convicting anyone of criminal behavior. Neither of those two rights are in the Sixth Amendment. The requirement of a neutral arbiter could be seen as an extension of the jury guarantee in the Sixth Amendment. Neutral juries are crucial to fair fact-finding, but have nothing to do with deciding legal issues or finding facts in the absence of a jury. That requires a neutral judge, and the Due Process Clause neatly closes that hole in the Sixth Amendment by forbidding judges to act in any case where their neutrality is fairly challenged. And that's why in Caperton versus Massey Cole, a decision a couple of years ago, a justice of the West Virginia Supreme Court was obliged to step down in a case involving a litigant who had openly spent more than $3 million to get him elected. He obviously had something of a stake in that case. My own brush, by the way, with due process neutrality is somewhat less august. I've already confessed to you a couple of lectures ago that I was guilty of a misdemeanor. You may recall that I confessed to be the guy who snuck into the courthouse after it closed with a cardboard L painted gold, and I pasted the cardboard L up right in the spot in God between O and D, where it says, "In God we trust." And I did it over the judge's bench in the New York City Criminal Court, making the slogan a lot more accurate. In gold we trust was much, much more accurate. Nobody found out, and I got away with it, and the statute of limitations ran, and I confessed to you the other night. Tonight, since the statute of limitations has really run, I'm going to confess to a felony. In the 1960s, Chuck Morgan, who is a flamboyant lawyer from Alabama, who's gone now. Chuck was an indispensable part of the ACLU's Southern litigation program. And he was also involved in several efforts to defend critics of the Vietnam War. And one Friday in June, Chuck argued a war resister case before a federal judge in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And that's where the prison was, Allenwood Prison, where the resister was being held. The judge promised a decision on Monday, so Chuck decided to spend the weekend at the Hershey Motor Inn. On Saturday night, he noticed that the local police chiefs were holding a meeting at the inn. Well lubricated, Chuck snuck into the room where they were having the meeting and began to heckle them. 5 minutes later, he was arrested for disorderly conduct and given a summons to report for trial. And when he woke up on Sunday morning, he had a bad headache and a sinking feeling that he had done something very stupid. Chuck's only bar membership was in Alabama. The folks in Alabama would have liked nothing better than to disbar or suspend him, thus taking him out of the civil rights litigation game. And a disorderly conduct conviction would give them a pretext. So Chuck called for reinforcements. And on Sunday morning, Tony Amsterdam, then the leading public interest litigator in the country, and maybe one of the most brilliant legal minds that we've ever had in the public interest world, answered Chuck's call for help. And we drove down from New York to Hershey to see what he could do. And I went with him, mostly to drive and to carry Tony's briefcase. When we arrived at 2 p.m., we went directly to the home of the local justice of the peace, who had jurisdiction over Chuck's minor charge. We introduced ourselves and explained to the justice of the peace how important Chuck was to the civil rights movement, how the folks in Alabama might use a conviction to make it impossible for him to continue, and how sorry Chuck was for making an ass of himself the night before. This we were saying before we spoke to Chuck, because we were sure he wasn't the least bit sorry. But we told the JP that he was very sorry. So we asked if an apology could clear the whole thing up. And the JP, Justice of the Peace, who was not a lawyer, he was a very pleasant man who drove the town school bus when he wasn't presiding over traffic tickets and other petty offenses. The JP expressed admiration for Chuck's work and said that he thought that an apology probably was the best way to resolve the situation. But, he said, that would put me in a real pickle. You see, I only get paid for convictions. Dismissals are free. Tony and I couldn't believe it. We couldn't believe it. The procedure of paying judges only for convictions had been held to violate the procedural due process clause in 1927 in a case called Toomey versus Ohio, but apparently nobody had told the folks in Pennsylvania. So given Toomey, it would have, of course, been easy to vacate any conviction. But in the meantime, Chuck probably would have been sidelined, and it could have taken 18 months before we did it. So at that point, I had to get rid of Tony. He's the most principled guy I ever met, and he would only have gotten in the way. So when Tony said he had to make a couple of phone calls, I was relieved to be left alone with the JP. Bribing him, you know, offering to pay his fee if there was a dismissal, was of course out of the question. I mean, I thought for a moment, and I asked the JP if he knew of a decent restaurant nearby. I told him that we had skipped lunch and that I was starved. The JP answered with a smile that it wouldn't be necessary for me to go to a restaurant. He had plenty of leftovers for a sandwich. I said, thanks, but I wouldn't think of not paying for lunch. He smiled wider and made me a nice sandwich. It was delicious, if a little pricey. But after all, the sandwich came with a get-out-of-jail card. So I paid the JP a little less than what his fees would have been for a conviction. He dismissed Chuck's case. We parted the best of friends. Tony and Chuck never knew, and the statute of limitations has run. And if any of you tell anybody, I'll have to kill you. So the evolution... the evolution of the beyond the reasonable doubt standard is more difficult to explain. Law almost always, I mean, you can understand why you could say as a matter of due process, you've got to have a neutral arbiter. How do you have a fair procedure without it? But law almost always unrolls in a state of great uncertainty. As we've seen, doubt often exists over the legal rules imposed by ambiguous text, and an even greater doubt exists over facts. You know, we try to reconstruct reality by using witnesses and by cross-examining them, but everybody in the process knows that judicial fact-finding, legal fact-finding, is vulnerable to error. And the Supreme Court uses the Due Process Clause as a device to deflect error by instructing fact-finders how sure they must be before finding that a contested fact exists. We call it burden of proof. In most garden variety civil actions involving money, the court instructs the jury to find facts only if they are demonstrated by a preponderance of the evidence, 51% certainly. But where a state or a federal government has charged a defendant with a criminal offense capable of depriving him of life, liberty, or even property, the court instructed us in 1970 in a case called In Re Winship that the Due Process Clause requires the jury to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, 99%, before it may find the facts needed for a criminal conviction. Under a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, the risk of factual error in a criminal proceeding is radically deflected in favor of freedom and against the state. I mean, you know the slogan. It's better for 99 guilty people to be acquitted on a reasonable doubt than it would be for a single innocent person to be convicted. And don't get me wrong. I believe in the reasonable doubt standard. In fact, as a young lawyer, I worked very hard in the cases that brought it into being. But the absence of reasonable doubt language from the elaborate criminal procedure protections in the text of the Sixth Amendment should give serious textualists real pause. If not from the Sixth Amendment's catalog of important rights, where does this a dramatic constitutional requirement in the Due Process Clause come from? It can't be, because the adoption of reasonable doubt is costless. The blithe assertion that it is better to let 99 guilty people free than to convict a single innocent person assumes that acquittals of guilty defendants are relatively costless. But if you look at the statistics on recidivism, that's just not true. Every acquittal of a guilty defendant frees someone with the risk of committing more crimes. When that cost is added to the equation, the balance becomes much harder. And as with so much else in constitutional law, only a judge's values can complete the equation one way or another. And that's what happened in In Re Winship. Now, if the clock had stopped in 1791, then we wouldn't have any, all I would do is talk to you about the criminal aspects of due process. But after 1791, something called the administrative state exploded. And government became very different than it was in those days. And we have a world now in which the government, especially the executive branch, the administrative branch, has enormous effect on our lives. Everything from getting a driver's license to a passport to a zoning variance. We come up against the government all the time. The procedural due process clause has played a remarkable and important role in the control of that process. If it weren't for the procedural due process clause, every time you had to go to a government bureaucrat, you would be essentially at the mercy of that bureaucrat. The due process clause tells us how that bureaucrat must behave when he's going to do something that can adversely affect it. Basically, it's replicated most of the Sixth Amendment. It says that we have to have notice when the bureaucrat wants to do something to us. We have to have a chance to argue with him and explain. We have to be able to produce witnesses. He has to have some reasoned explanation for why he's doing it. It can't be arbitrary. But it's not a complete fit. There are no juries in the administrative process. There's no unbending right to cross-examination. And there's no compulsory process. Most importantly, the burden of proof does not require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't even require preponderance, merely a rational basis for the decision. So although the procedural due process clause is hugely important in policing the relationships of the individual to the state, even in the administrative context, it is a pale shadow of what it is in the criminal context. So that takes us to the last of the meanings. The mystery of substantive due process. Now, if it's hard to find in the text federalism due process, it's impossible to find textual or historical basis for substantive due process. Under substantive due process, a judge decides whether a legislative act violates fundamental aspects of freedom that are simply not protected in the constitutional text. In effect, the substantive due process clause functions as a safety net, freedom safety net under the Constitution, providing protection to activities deemed crucial by the judge to a genuinely free society, whether or not the founders thought of putting them into the Bill of Rights. The problem, of course, is that lacking any guidance in text or history, a judge is wholly free to impose his or her values on the society through the open-ended magic of the substantive due process clause. And indeed, if substantive due process is an open-ended protection of ordered liberty, why do we need the rest of the Bill of Rights? Early in the 19th century, Chief Justice Marshall dabbled in substantive due process, but its first full-blown use was in Dred Scott, where the Supreme Court struck down the Constitution, as a deprivation of due process, the Missouri Compromise of 1820, saying anything that will take our property and slaves away is a violation of substantive due process. So forget about it, Congress. You cannot legislate on slavery. There is a built-in property interest protected by the substantive due process clause that overrides anything that the majority wants to do about it. And we had to fight a civil war to reverse that appalling decision. And you would think we learned something from it. You would think we wouldn't do it anymore, that we wouldn't do substantive due process anymore. As soon as the 14th Amendment gets passed, the Supreme Court says that a corporation is a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment, and every corporate lawyer in America rediscovers substantive due process. And what they do is they deploy it as a weapon against efforts to regulate the marketplace. They begin to argue that you can't regulate in a way that takes my property away. So in 1897, which is a watershed case, the Supreme Court struck down rate regulation of a grain elevator. The grain elevator, the argument was exploiting the farmers, and so they pushed the rates down from the grain elevator. The Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional because they said the rates are too low. You're depriving the grain elevator owner of his God-given right to a certain return on his capital. And that's a deprivation of substantive due process. Well, if that's the law, you can't regulate the marketplace. And that's indeed what happened. In the first 30 years of the 20th century, the Supreme Court had an orgy of substantive due process. They struck down maximum hour laws in Lochner. They struck down minimum wage laws in Adair. They struck down child labor laws in Atkins versus the Children's Hospital, to the point where it was impossible to regulate the economy because you would violate substantive due process. And you know what that brought us? It brought us the Depression. What occurred was a totally unregulated economy ran amok, collapsed in 1927, and it was the Depression that ended substantive due process. A chastened court said, gee, I guess maybe you can regulate the economy. So in 1934, they upheld milk price regulations, and in 1937, they just gave up the ghost and said, go ahead and regulate the economy as long as you're acting rationally. So that ended, one would think, substantive due process. You would think that you put a stake through its heart, but you'd be wrong, because the liberal judges are just as willing to use it as the conservative judges. In 1940, for example, they're confronted with a law that provides for compulsory sterilization. Now, look in the text of the Constitution. You're not going to see anything there about compulsory sterilization. So what the Supreme Court says in 1940 is that it violates substantive due process. Now, at least they're using it to protect liberty in a decent way and not freezing off the market. But all that means is it all depends who you have in the court. If you have one group of justices that want to pursue economic substantive due process and the other group of judges that want to pursue liberty, a substantive due process, it's an accident of who gets into the court. Not the text of the Constitution, not the desire of the majority to do anything. It's who happens to be in the court that will regulate and govern us. And that was then used in Griswold versus Connecticut to protect contraception. So substantive due process protects our contraception rights. Griswold was then used in perhaps the most important case that we have, which is Roe v. Wade, to protect abortion rights. And then it was used again in Lawrence versus Texas to protect gays against criminal prosecution for consensual sodomy. And we're trying to use it now to create the autonomous right of an individual to decide when to terminate life under settings of great pain and letting somebody say, enough, I don't want to live anymore. Now, this is a wonderful set of goals. The question is the substantive due process clause the right way to do it? As I'm going to try to talk to you about in the last lecture, the Ninth Amendment gives us a different and I think much more disciplined way of doing it without necessarily gambling that these precedents someday, a generation from now, are going to be used economically and not to create liberty. And the question is the substantive due process clause a legitimate way of making law? I think the answer is that it's not, despite the fact that it can be used for wonderful things. In my experience, every one of those wonderful things is capable of being defended by a different provision of the Constitution. You can use freedom of association. You can use equality. There's always another provision that will get you what you need without validating substantive due process and all the risks that it entails. And I'm going to close by quoting the great legal philosopher, Mick Jagger, who tells us that in constitutional law, as in life, you can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need. Thank you. So let the record show that we ended at 7:30. I didn't think I was going to make it. And those of you who want to put your names down, I will be there tonight to talk about all the stuff I left out. The tradition is a tradition. I've been up here for 7 lectures, and I'm already talking about tradition. That's what lawyers do. The tradition is that anybody who feels they should leave, who has something else to do, please don't feel any obligation to stay. But if you have questions, come on up to the mics and I'll try to respond to any of your questions.
So my recollection of Griswold, and I want to ask you to correct it or fix it, is that it more depended upon a discovery or invention of a right to privacy than on substantive due process. Can you?
Yes, but the right to privacy was protected by substantive due process. I mean, there's a right to privacy, but since there's no language in the Constitution saying a right to privacy is protected, you need a textual hook for it. So what they said is the right to privacy is so fundamental to being a dignified human being that it's part of substantive due process, and it's substantive due process that protects it. The alternative would be the Ninth Amendment, which I'm going to try to talk about on the last day, which gives an alternative way of doing it, and I think a much more disciplined way of reaching that point. And Douglas argued for the Ninth Amendment in Griswold, but the majority of the court went substantive due process.
That kind of dovetails with what I want to ask. I'd like you to discuss how you think, or poof, you're a textualist. So defend textualism against what you just talked about in terms of beyond a reasonable doubt is not in due process. And as far as privacy goes, privacy is in the Constitution. Search and seizure is a privacy concept. Free exercise of religion is a privacy concept.
It's just a great question. What you've done, he's just stolen my final lecture. really, nicely done. I'm going to argue in the last lecture that privacy is found in the Constitution. It's found in a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about next week, embedded in the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments. And that the Ninth Amendment allows you to expand something that's already there by analogy to other things. Just like Justice Harlan, it's only 6 textual ideas in the First Amendment. Freedom of association is not in the First Amendment. What Justice Harlan did, the second Justice Harlan, is he said, well, we need something else to complete it. And since it's so closely connected to the stuff on either side of it, I'm dropping freedom of association in between assembly and petition. And so I'm going to have a 7th non-textual idea. I'm going to argue that's exactly what the Ninth Amendment tells us we should do. But that's getting ahead of myself. But it's a good question. It's much better to do it that way than do it through the raw, naked power of substantive due process. Okay, guys.